Hi, everyone, and welcome back to Airway First, the podcast from the Children's Airway First Foundation. I'm your host, Rebecca St. James. Today, I'm excited to welcome back one of our favorite guests, pediatric ENT specialist, Dr. David McIntosh. This is part one of our two-part series, and it builds upon our initial conversations with Dr. McIntosh, which were episodes 13 and 14, and you can find those links in our show notes. So without further ado, let's get right to it and jump into our conversation with Dr. David McIntosh. Thank you so much for joining us again on the show, Dr. McIntosh. I am so thrilled to have you back here.
It really is a great pleasure. It's a great foundation, and it's my privilege. Thank you.
Thanks. And I love our talks. And I will tell you, our parents have had a lot of questions. So I really appreciate you taking the time to come in and let's talk about some of these. So let's go ahead and just dive right in, because
sounds good.
ADHD, you and I were talking a little bit about this before, is a very big issue in America. I know it's a global thing, but in America, the numbers are staggering, the number of children that are diagnosed, something like one in four diagnosed with ADHD, which is, I can't even get my brain around that. But it makes sense to me because I look at my daughters when they were growing up, all of their friends, how many of them were diagnosed with ADHD? That's just like you and I talked about, alarm bells. But what to me is most upsetting is most of these kids are getting prescriptions to regulate this.
Yeah.
When the reality is, that's probably not even the driving force behind it.
Look, I mean, those numbers are staggering. They, you know, and I think this is, you know, one of those moments where you pause and go, all right, so this is what's going on in our part of, you know, the world. Is this happening everywhere else? And the answer is no. In terms of that level of degree, it's not anything like that at all. We do know that the diagnosis has become more common, you know, in time, partly because the condition has been defined and refined over time. So ADHD as a diagnosis, you know, in terms of being in the books and so forth, that only came about in the late 80s and then got refined in the 90s and 2000s. So it sort of has been morphed and shaped over time. And it's sort of, I remember when I went to school, you know, there was no such thing, but it wasn't to say, you know, in terms of it being a diagnosis, but there were certainly kids in the class that were having trouble concentrating, focusing, that led to them being a little bit disruptive. They were the kids that got sat in the corner, you know, face the wall sort of stuff. That was, you know, that was the tough love that we grew up with.
And
in that respect, you know, there was not even a thought that we'd be medicating kids in my school class back when I was a kid to slow them down.
No.
So that was obviously the dynamic then. But, you know, as we've emerged and we've come to understand, there are some things we can do for these kids that are beneficial to them. That's certainly perfectly reasonable. But it all comes into the context of, have you made sure that there's nothing else going on that could be masquerading as ADHD, or that could be exacerbating symptoms that look like ADHD? And I think in terms of, you know, obviously my focus and insights as an ear, nose and throat surgeon comes down to breathing and sleep. And there was a research paper that really was, in my mind, there's all these little papers out there that I think are the game changers. And this is one of them. And this was in about 2006. And it came out of Chicago with the researcher was Shervin, C-H-E-R-V-I-N was the surname. And it was a really interesting study because we have to realize there's sort of a confluence of events going on. So we have ADHD being sort of defined and refined, but starting from the late 70s, but really picking up in the 90s and then progressing forwards into the 2000s, is this whole thing about kids' airway, breathing, sleep, and in particular, the starting point was sleep apnea. And with the sleep apnea story in this Chicago study, What they did was that they had a cohort of children that were coming in for adenoid and tonsil surgery because these children had obstructive sleep apnea due to big tonsils and adenoids, which is, kind of the vibe and the gist for a lot of the scenarios that play out in this context. But what they did is they tapped their colleagues next door on the shoulder. Their colleagues were the psychologists and the psychiatrists. And to sort of, present a little bit of a play story here, they basically said, "Hey, we want you to come and look at these kids." And the psychology and psychiatry department was dumbfounded. They go, "Oh my gosh, you got all these kids with ADHD." And so these kids had fulfilled all the criteria, basically, of ADHD. So, being disruptive and trouble with concentrating, trouble with focusing, just tick, 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 and tick. And then the ENT said, "Yeah, hold my drink, come back in 12 months." So the kids had the surgery. 12 months later, the researchers come back again and they go, "Wow, what did you do? All this ADHD that you had, it's gone." And that's what happened. And it
Because it
was
was an
just like,
ADHD,
so you have to go, there's nothing about having an anesthetic or an operation that cures ADHD. So the problem was the diagnosis. It'd be like, if you break your leg and I give you an antibiotic and your leg gets better. Well, that antibiotic didn't make your leg better. It was probably something else, like maybe
Who
the
knows?
orthopedic surgeon. Okay.
Right.
So you can't say antibiotics fix broken legs, and you can't say surgery fixes ADHD. The diagnosis was wrong. So so from that point of view onwards, there was a really significant awareness of the impact on ch children in terms of their learning and behavior and the misdiagnosis of ADHD. And the reason that this is such a red flag is, apart from getting the diagnosis wrong, is that the treatment, which the amphetamine-based medications in particular, makes sleep a real problem. They interfere with sleep. So if you have a child that has one sleep problem and you medicate the symptoms of that sleep problem with something that also in its own right makes sleep worse, you're actually making the child worse in the process. And the reason for this is the central theme of just how important sleep is. And I can again recall going to medical school. And we had probably, if we were lucky, maybe four or five lectures on sleep in terms of our physiology coverage. So we learn about breathing, we learn about the cardiovascular system and the digestive system. And we did do sleep, but it was very basic, very primitive. But again, that was in the late 90s. Yes, I'm that old. And sleep as a thing wasn't a thing then. So there was no sleep medicine. There was nothing on the pathology radar significant enough at the time in my medical school education to even talk about something like sleep apnea. So it was in adults, it was sort of, it was
Yeah, let
just
alone kids.
it was just starting to creep in to our awareness. And when that happens, it takes a long time for a medical school curriculum to change. It's got to be something big and radical and so forth. And even to this day, sleep is not a big component of medical school education. It's not a big
Still blows my
component.
mind.
Yeah, and it's not a big component of postgraduate education programs unless you're doing the sleep medicine programs. So, when I did my ENT training, I was kind of in the right place at the right time in Australia at the time, because I was in the program where there was only one ENT surgeon in the whole country that had any idea about sleep apnea. And the reason he had that idea is that he'd gone over to the US, come to your place, but at Stanford, and learned from the guys there and brought that back to our ENT program in Australia. And that was in the late 90s, early 2000s. So that's the only reason that it hit my radar is because of that one person. So that was a really pivotal, element of how it played out. But that was
And there
focused
is a and there's a huge delay, right? Is we're even learning just
huge,
on the airway
huge.
side because
Yeah.
we can remember 2016 talking about airway was still new. And when we went to
Yep.
Australia this year, That was one of the first really big conferences there. So that's how long it has taken to get there.
There's usually somewhere between a 10 to 20 year delay from the science permeating into clinical medicine.
Wow.
And there's a reason for that is that, again, things are changing, but again, I'm just showing my age. We used to rely on these things called books. That was it. All right. When I was at university initially, there was no such thing as the internet. I can remember in
I remember
95.
schlepping books, and now kids have iPads, and I was like, "Where are all your books? What are you doing?"
No, the reason that we were so trim and good looking back then is because we were carrying all these
We had to
books around.
schlep all that, right?
That was our exercise program right there. We'd be carrying around pounds and pounds of books, 20, 30 pounds worth of books all the time. It was
True
just they
story. And I'm sure everybody did this because we'd all have our backpacks on one shoulder. So you'd like a rib would move and you'd get these pangs. And I remember all that.
100%. But good for our core strength. So that was sort of going on in the background. So because we were relying on books, once a book's printed back in the day,
You can't really change it.
you wouldn't reprint for another 5 to 7 years. And then whatever's in that book is basically been through the editorial process, which takes a year or two. So by the time that book hits there, it's already 2 years out of date. And then we're going to use it for the next 5 to 7 years. So that could easily rack up to 10 years that book's, there. And then we'll bring out a new edition down the track.
Wow.
But then, the world's changed, tenfold. So that's actually the reality. And then the other thing is, which I found quite interesting, because I only learned this in the past week, with your university medical curriculums, they're all pretty much the same, because there's a private organization in the US that actually sets the standards. So
Perfect.
as attractive as it might be to go to these big, expensive universities, your actual medical curriculum is pretty much the same as a
Across
standardized
the board.
feature. So until the people sitting around that table decide to bring sleep into the university, it's not going to happen anywhere, as a concept. So, and then it permeates forwards, because like I said, in the postgraduate, it doesn't really get a mention. And it's extraordinary, because if we just pause for a moment, you think about what is the one thing that we do more of than anything else, it's sleep. Throughout the day, I'm sitting, I'm standing, I'm walking, I'm talking, I'm moving, but I'm not doing that for 8 to 10 hours without any, and it should be without any interruption. It's the thing that we do more than anything else on a consistent basis. There's nothing else that we sit down and
Is
do
it, what
8
was
to
it,
10
like a
hours.
third of your life is
It
spent
is.
sleeping? Is that right? Is that the
Yeah,
right
correct.
stat?
Well, I mean, it's a simple math thing, right? Like 24 hours in a day, 8 to 10 hours of sleep, depending on how old you are. So when you're really old, like getting to my dinosaur age, you tend to need less sleep. But when we first kick off, I'm talking babies, like they're like cats. It's just they feed and they sleep, and then they sleep some
And that's
more.
it.
And there's a very good reason for that, and that is, I really hope we will come to this, and that is what we're coming to realize is the importance of sleep. And the importance of sleep, front and center, is about this thing we call the brain. And it's a thing that we, again, kind of take for granted. But it's an extraordinary machine in terms of what it does.
And before we get too far down this, I want to ask a question, and you can completely tell me that I'm off my rocker. But you mentioned that ADHD really kind of came into mainstream, especially in schools, late 70s and in the 80s. So, I mean, I'm with you.
Oh,
That's my
no. So
world.
that was the 70s and 80s. That was in reference to the breathing and sleep apnea in kids. So
Oh, okay.
the ADHD, as in terms of hitting the textbooks, so it was called the DSM criteria, which is a sort of categorization of mental health issues.
Okay.
That hit in the 80s. Okay, in terms of there, and but then it got sort of changed and chopped around and refined and so forth. As time went by, it sort of got, people got a little bit more sophisticated in terms of defining it. So that's when it could start to be diagnosed as such, because you could basically get a checklist and go, oh yeah, tick, 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 and
They have
tick.
all these things.
You
Okay.
tick
Yeah.
the
Because
boxes. Yeah.
where I was going was I was thinking, well, we were one of the first generations, like the full generation that started with retractive braces. So to me, it's like, oh, look, that makes sense on the timeline that.
Yeah, retractive braces is an interesting conversation in itself, and I make this fun link. So, retractive braces, extraction retraction is a interesting thing, and I'm one of those kids that had it. And from what I've understood from the history, it actually started in Australia. So it was,
Really?
oh,
Oh, thanks.
apparently. But it's not true. I don't care, because we're not going to let the facts get in the way of the good story here,
That's
because
okay.
it's
You guys
ironic.
still have the Bee Gees, so you're fine, right? You're
Yeah,
good.
well, you're not taking those from us.
That's what I'm
So,
saying. See, you've got great history. You're good.
totally. So the knock-on follow-on effect, that it's sort of somewhat ironic in terms of trying to play this story out, is Australia also invented CPAP. So we worked out how to retract the jaws, and then we worked out how to give them CPAP later on. And we're also pretty prominent in creating mandibular advancement splints. So, yeah, go Australia.
Yeah, well, these things happen. All
Yeah,
right,
exactly.
so you kind of touched on it, so let's just go full throttle now on brain, because we know that when kids don't sleep and they don't breathe correctly, so we're talking mouth breathers, and now they snore at night. We know, and I don't think a lot of parents really understand though, that it impacts your prefrontal cortex and it can actually lower a child's IQ by up to 10 points. Why aren't people talking about that? Why isn't that just like this big red blinking, hey, close your mouth? I mean, that alone should be enough, I would think.
Yeah, look, it's extraordinary, isn't it? It's again, I think, I talked about how it takes so long for information to permeate into the textbooks. And then it takes even longer again to permeate into, the mindset of people. So, we know it's doable. We proved through that, thing called COVID, just how quickly people learned the word coronavirus.
Yes.
Just, like that, it spread like wildfire, in terms of the disease and the knowledge of the same.
Right.
Okay. And I guess partly that was because it was front and center, and it did actually impact on people, in a real way,
Yeah,
so
just about
that
everyone, yeah.
awareness that was out there. Whereas this thing, this is sort of tucked away, and the scenario is not unusual. Like, everyone's got home, the parents have done the day, they want to just settle the kids down and just have some, quiet time to themselves. And, we're in a situation where, with some people's housing, not everyone's, the kids have, one part of the house down one end and the parents are down the other. So as soon as the kids are put away, there's no idea and no insight as to what that child is doing through the night with their breathing and the sleep. And then the parent comes and tries to wake them up in the morning, and the kid is tired and grumpy, and I don't want to get up, I don't want to go to
And
school.
we've normalized that to where it's like,
And you
oh, they're
just go, oh,
teenagers,
the
that's
kid
what they
doesn't want to
do.
go to snore. Sorry, the kid just doesn't want to go to school. And then it's the weekend, but on the weekend they seem to be up and wanting to watch the cartoons on TV. That was my thing back in the day
Yeah, I was
before
going to
we.
say, mine don't do that. They just sleep longer and then they get up and watch TV. Yeah.
So it was sort of like, oh, this is all just about school avoidance and so forth, but it wasn't. And then, like I said, the parents don't know. So this is, you're right. We don't let children consume alcohol before a certain age. In my country, it's 18, and yours, it's 21. There's a reason for that. We don't let children play with mercury. There's a reason for that. We are concerned about children being exposed to iron, as to lead, because of the damage it does to the brain. There's a reason for that. But if we pause for a moment and just look at how the brain works and functions, the brain is an evolving machine. It's kind of, they're talking about how AI can, emerge and evolve, and eventually, we have that whole Terminator movie, you know, scenario playing out with Skynet that becomes self-aware and turns on the creators. Well, the brain is an ever-evolving, constant learning machine. And the most amount of brain development that happens is in the first few years of life, because that's when the brain is getting stuff sorted. The fact that, you know, we can communicate now, like you and I are, is because you and I learned how to talk. Now, to do that, we needed a brain that worked, connected to the ears and connected to the muscles, and then coordinating it and refining it. So we're going from babble to words to sentences to War and Peace. That's, you know, the movement of time. And what we've learned about sleep is that the learning part happens at nighttime. It actually happens when we sleep. So the brain has a short-term and then a long-term memory system, you know, a bit like your computer. And you know, if I'm typing into a document, it will remember that. But if unless I click the save button, if I my computer crashes before I hit save, I've lost that whole document. And we've all lived those experiences. Maybe not the kids today. They don't know how lucky they've got it with autosave and
No
cloud
kidding.
computing. But you know, just you know, you know, parents at least can relate to this. And you know, you've lost that whole document and you've got to start again because you didn't save it. It's the same. Sleep is your save button in terms of your memory. That's when it happens. But for it to happen, it needs to be good quality sleep because the brain is basically working through, you know, this is my list of things to do. And if you have a list of things to do in your day and something comes along and distracts you and interrupts, you might not get around to doing what you were supposed to be doing, and you just got to miss that opportunity. It's the same for the brain. But it's the problem with this thing that we're talking about, so mouth breathing, snoring, sleep apnea, they're all part of what we call sleep disordered breathing. And it really is a problem because the condition, in simple terms, impacts the brain in two ways. The first way is it knocks down the oxygen supply. Now that's bad. The brain is so important to the body, it has a disproportionate amount of blood flow. So it, by body weight, it is 2% of the weight of the body. Okay, 2%. But it is 20% of the blood flow. So it is has a disproportionate amount of blood flow. And that is because its activity is through the charts. It, you know, you know, there's no moment where the brain stops. You know, like the gut will sort of be in a rested state until you eat, and then it sort of has it. Oh, okay, we've got to do stuff. Your heart, you know, has its baseline, but it will be elevated when you go and do some exercise or physical activities of some sort. Your brain is front and center controlling all of what I just told you about. And you don't even know about it. And then, you know, right now, wherever you're sitting, your brain knows exactly where your knee is. It knows exactly where your big toe is. It knows exactly if, you know, the air is warm or cold. It knows if there's a car that just passed your house. And, you know, it knows whether to pay attention to those things or ignore those things and when they're important and when they're not. It's extraordinary. And this is the problem, is that the oxygen supply is compromised, but the other thing is the sleep is disrupted. So in the sleep nomenclature, you know, terminology, we talk about an arousal. An arousal basically means something where you are in a certain level of sleep, and we have different sort of, you know, we talk about light sleep and deep sleep to keep it simple. And an arousal is where you bounce up higher in your level of sleep than you should have, because something happened that interrupted it. And that's again where the breathing comes in, because the oxygen not only is that you know, something that's deprived to the brain in what it wants and needs, but it gets to the point where the brain starts to worry about it in the background and starts to wake you up to go, I don't know what's going on here, but you need to breathe properly. And whatever you're doing right now, it ain't working for me. And that then mucks up the brain's, you know, system at night. And it's not just about learning. It's also, you know, the analogy that I use, it's the street sweeper at night. So you sort of wake up to your city and the streets are immaculate and pristine, but then these humans come along, and then by the end of the day it looks pretty terrible. And then first thing in the morning, those street sweepers have been out and made it look glorious again. That's actually the same story in the brain. There's a whole element of the street sweeper equivalent in the brain that happens when we sleep. So not only is it important for learning, it's also important for basically clearing out the metabolic byproducts and the toxins and so forth that have accumulated in the brain. It's so active, that it just cannot keep up with itself to clean out the metabolic byproducts of the day. So it created this system at night to do it for it. It's extraordinary. It's absolutely amazing. And people will know this as parents. Like, what are you like after a bad night's sleep? Anyone that has, brought up a child, in those early days, especially the mother, let's be honest, the dads get off a bit, but the mums are front and center. We have these terms, I've got pregnancy brain, I've got baby brain, and I've got brain fog. What do all these terms sort of tie back to? Well, a lot of it ties back to, I didn't really sleep really good last night.
Because you were up with a tiny person, yeah, all night.
they kept, and then it's
Even if
just
they
like,
sleep on you wake up because they move, you wake up, just you don't sleep.
Exactly. So all those sort of dynamics, play into it. So, and then what you're like the next day. You start forgetting things. You and it's all you didn't sleep. So what? So and this is in the context for an adult of a brain that is nowhere near as developmentally in demand as a child's. So the impact. This is why the impact on children is significantly higher. Is that their brains are still going through a huge amount of growth and development, and it needs that sleep. That's why children need much longer sleep time than they do as adolescents and adults. So, we're talking like, 10 plus hours for children, as opposed to, the sort of more 8-ish hours for adults.
Just
And
well.
the, yeah,
Well,
and
I was
the,
going to ask a quick question because you mentioned when we were talking just a moment ago about the impact on IQs, and I posed the question. I mean, I know you're not omnipotent; you don't know all this, but it boggles my mind because, at least in the U.S., the average IQ is now under 100. How is that not alarming? How is that not a big sign? Is it like this in other parts of the world? I mean, to me, that's a big red flag.
Yeah. All right. So
I mean, and all joking aside, you mentioned the Terminator. I'm less fearful of computers because I'm very nice to my Siri and everything. I tell her I love her and things like that, just in case. But I'm more concerned of the movie Idiocracy because to me, if our IQs keep going down, that's where we're going.
The reason I'm pausing and taking deep breaths is that I know the answer, but I don't want to cause offense. So let's just call it for what it is, because sometimes you've got to do that. I love going to the US, okay? But there are some very, very big problems that you've got over there. And one of your big problems is that your food, okay, one of these basic things, it ain't good. It really
Oh, the
isn't.
American diet is horrible.
It is not good. But you are so immersed in it, and it is so normalized. And it's even weaponized now in terms of, if you say something about, I heard the other day that, there was pushback about having soft drinks on your food stamp program, saying, and then it was saying, well, if you take that off, that's racist. It's like, oh boy.
Well, that sounds like us, yeah.
That's what happens. And that's basically driven by a lot of the lobbying and stuff that's funded by the same companies that are selling these things.
Well, we've
So
talked to people like Dr. Becky Andrews, or we've read Stephen Lin's book and some of the others that impacts not only your jaw development, but that's impacting your brain as well, what we're
It
eating.
really is. It really is. You know, the nutrition is so front and center to health and well-being.
Yeah,
So
that's the
you
third or
have,
fourth pillar, isn't it? I mean, I've heard it that it's
you know,
airway,
you sort of,
sleep, and nutrition.
absolutely. And you know, if we're gonna, go on that tangent and be honest about it, look, you got to call it for what it is. You know, there's, you know, I mean, there's only so long you can put your head in the sand, as a sort of a defense mechanism, and it don't
Yeah.
work. That thing that you're hiding from, it's still sitting there. As soon as you pull your head out of the sand and look around, it's there. And we're not trying to shame people, and we should
This goes
never
back to you
have made
don't
it.
know what you don't know, and that's okay, but now we know.
It should never have been weaponized in terms of making it thing about race or about culture or about economies. It really shouldn't have
Right.
been. It should have been, hey, we've created a problem here. We have basically allowed an industry, which in your country is allowed to use things that are banned in food products elsewhere. So, and you can just look over the border, just go over to Canada. Like some of your breakfast cereals, they're not the same. It's the same box with the same picture. Go look at the ingredient list. It is not the same. And you go, well, why is that? Well, that's because Canada banned those things. Okay. So you're right. It's just like, wow, why aren't these red flags,
Going off.
going around and so forth?
And I'll tell you what, I am one of those parents, by the way, that had my own rude awakening because I was diagnosed with cancer. And I had to step back and go, I don't understand why. And I started doing this, like I think a lot of people do, this deep dive. And not only do I not go to drive-throughs anymore, I mean, that's off the table, but the things I buy are very different now. And I stay on the outsides of our American stores because all the crap's in the middle.
Correct.
But I wouldn't have known, and I was a biology major and I had no idea. I just, so parents don't know here. You just, it's what we were indoctrinated with.
And look, let's be honest, all this stuff, it's heavily processed and it's cheap. And that
Yes.
unfortunately does play into the economy of things. And I understand that. I'm not judgmental, I'm a realist. But the reason it's cheap is because they took all the good stuff out of it.
Right.
And
So
they
that's
jammed it
affecting your
full.
brain.
So they jammed it with the stuff that the brain's not really so, it doesn't need it in anywhere near the amount that it's supplied in. So you've got that dynamic, that's that, if you're going to look at one thing and one thing only, that would be front and center. That really needs to change. But the problem
Well,
you've
because that
got
we're back to permeating,
is,
that does permeate everything. Because if you eat like crap, your body's gonna behave sluggish. You're not optimal. So now your brain's not optimized. And then when you sleep, you're not even gonna get that.
And you can look at this. You look at something like a thoroughbred racehorse, okay? A horse that has the potential to, win the Kentucky Derby and make you millions of dollars, and then you put it out to stud afterwards, where you make even more millions of dollars. I guarantee you will not be giving that horse anything other than the best of the best of the best.
Right.
And you go look at the owners of those horses. They are not giving themselves the best of the best of the best.
That's a true story. Yeah.
Yeah, they're not. So it's not a financial thing. When I can give you that example, you go look at, your extremely wealthy people out there, and it used to be about showing off the cars and the boats and the private planes. Now you look at Jeff Bezos, what's it about? Showing off how physically fit and good he looks. Now, admittedly, he's
Right.
already done all the other show up with everything else, but
Right.
that's now become the billionaire brag, is about being, trim, taut, and terrific. So actually turning that ship around from, you go look at the movies, you look at those, rich, aristocratic, dictatorial, they're all portrayed as heavily overweight people that just sit around
Right.
and they're gluttonous. So, we have these really interesting stereotypes that actually portray real life sometimes. But anyway, that was a rabbit hole. You mentioned the prefrontal cortex, just to circle back
Yes. Yeah.
to that element, because like I said, with the brain being greedy and soaking up oxygen and so forth, the other thing it soaks up, by the way, is sugar. That's its prime thing. And people have this sugar, sugar, sugar thing. And well, that's all, it's the dose that makes the poison. So sugar's good, but the amount of sugar that we're having is extraordinary. And again, that
Which is
circles back
part of
to
why I
the
brought up nutrition, because you don't realize how much we're giving our kids. You think goldfish, there's not in there. Oh, flip it over. It's there.
I think the statistic is that the amount of sugar that we now consume as in a week is what we used to consume as in a year,
In a year.
in a week.
Which is
So again,
mind-blowing.
it just shows you that our system works just fine with whatever we were doing a long time before. So that's part of the dynamic there, and it does feed into to airway problems, because as you put on weight, that feeds into airway problems. So all these things are intertwined.
Exactly.
So there is actually a very good reason for bringing these things up. But when it comes to the brain, I said it gets 20% of the blood flow. Now, when you have sleep disordered breathing, it actually bounces up to about 25 to 30% of the blood flow. So the brain has a mechanism that says that, all right, I'm not getting enough oxygen, I'm not getting enough energy, or whatever the like, but primarily the oxygen. So give me more blood. But it also has the ability to regulate which parts of the brain are getting the blood in proportions. And the part of the brain that gets sacrificed relative to the others is the thing that you just mentioned, is that prefrontal
So
cortex.
prefrontal,
Okay. So just to give people an understanding of what we're talking about.
You can find out more about the Children's Airway First Foundation and our mission to fix before six on our website at childrensairwayfirst.org. The CAF website offers tons of great resources for both parents and medical professionals. Visit our Parents Portal, Clinicians Corner, Resource Center, and Video Library to see for yourself. We also encourage parents to join the Airway Huddle, our Facebook support group, which was created for parents of children with airway and sleep-related issues. You can access the Airway Huddle support group at facebook.com/groups/Airway Huddle. As a reminder, this podcast and the opinions expressed here are not a medical diagnosis. If you suspect your child might have an airway issue, contact your pediatric airway dentist or pediatrician. And now, let's jump back into today's episode.
Our brains are divided up into sections, front, back, left, right, inside, outside. Is this sort of a generic thing? And we generalize as to which parts of the brain do things. So the frontal lobe is at the front of the brain. Okay, that's its name. And prefrontal is in front of that again. Okay, so or sorry, it's just behind that, sorry. So we've got those sorts of things, but collectively this frontal part of the brain is tied in with our emotional regulation and our sort of our social norms. Now, there was a movie that some people out there might have watched. It's based on the book, Jack Nicholas. It's One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Okay. And it describes the journey of a person in a mental institution back in the day. And the conclusion of the movie, he's had a procedure where he's totally different. And that procedure was a frontal lobotomy. Okay. And that was a treatment that was spruiked, and it was actually a, traveling roadshow of sorts back in the US in the day, where they were doing that to, cure mental illness. But then they said, well, it cures everything. And what you're doing is that they're physically breaking the connection of that frontal region of the brain to the rest of the brain. And that's associated with personality changes. And in particular, the personality change that happens is that you lose your inhibitions a bit. So you're less restrained in your behaviors in some respect. Or, hey, listen to what I just said. The prefrontal region is underactive in these children with ADHD-like symptoms because of sleep-disordered breathing. It's kind of like a frontal lobotomy in terms of its impact. Why? Because they're disinhibited. And this is where people get confused, because you go, well, hang on a sec. You told me that if you don't sleep properly, you're tired. I've got a kid that's got more energy than any of us know what to do with. So I'm calling you out. You don't know what you're talking about. And I go, okay, let's just pause for a moment. What could be going on here? It's not that a child with ADHD has more energy. They have unregulated energy. And that is the problem. So the comparison that I make is it's like a car. Okay, your car has an accelerator, and we're all the same model. Every single one of us, we're all the same model, just for the analogy, and we've all got the same accelerating speed. So if we all put our foot down, we're all going to go at the same speed relative to how much we're putting the accelerator down. The children with ADHD, they don't have a brake. So that when we're speeding up to a corner, we will take our foot off the accelerator and start braking to slow down to take that corner. Those kids don't
No, you
have the
don't.
brake. So they just shoot forwards, and then they're doing something that they shouldn't be doing. That is why they manifest as having more energy. It's not, they just can't contain and control what they've got
So what
because.
happens when we take these kids that really don't have ADHD and we medicate them?
Yeah. Well, like I said, the problem is, in particular, is we muck up their sleep. And they're sort of labeled as a, poor responder to medications. So then we find different medications. So like, oh, hang on, I got a pill for this, but oh, that pill didn't work. Well, let me give you another pill. And then we start using sedative medications in these kids, and start, to slow them down. We medicate them to slow them down. So it's all just this, and again, it's kind of like, you've got this drug industry, you've got a food industry, you've got a sugar industry. Like, do the math on this one,
You hate
So,
America. Yeah.
this is the challenge. So that's why when it comes to behavior, what you got to just pause for a moment is that what you saw happen just then is a reflection on how that brain works. Okay, so the fact that you and I are sitting here and I'm still sitting and I haven't got up and walked around three times and so forth, well, my brain contained that. It wasn't even a thought to do that. Whereas a child with troubles with concentration, you go, well, what we're seeing is a symptom. It's a symptom of brain function. Now, is that brain not functioning properly because there is some sort of neurodevelopmental issue which ties in with the ADHD? Or is it because they've had, some really, really bad breathing and sleep, as an alternative? And I really, even to sort of, put this in the picture of things, there's no reason why you can't have both happening at the same time. People go, oh, so if I get my child's breathing fixed, the ADHD will go away. And well, let's just pause on that for a moment. We don't know how much the breathing and sleep is impacting, contributing to what we're seeing here. It's possible your child does have both. It's not like there's one or the other here. You can have both. But what we do know is when there is both, when we get the breathing and sleep better, there may still be a need for medication. We're not going to deny that the role of
Right,
that.
because there are some
Yeah,
true actual ADHD kids.
it's a
It's
real
not
thing.
this many, it's like this many.
Well, this is the problem, is there's an over-diagnosis and over-medication. But in the context where it is a real thing, a lot of those children, when they're breathing and sleep better, they still need the medication, but the dosages they need is a lot less. So that's got to be a good thing. Like, like anything with medication, you want the dose you take is the least amount possible to give you the benefit that you need, without then also the trade-off with the side effects that come from it. So, if we're in a scenario where we can get some kids entirely off medication because the diagnosis is wrong, and another group of kids on lesser doses of medication because they have a second disease process that is contributing to their symptoms of ADHD, like every parent wants the best for their child is sort of, the premise that we're programmed for, so this is, again, we have all these sort of accidental jokes, but this has to be the wake-up call, right? We're talking about sleep. This is the wake-up call, and I think the simple thing that parents need, and this can be your sound grab to promote this. There's only, in my mind, there's only three things a parent needs to know about sleep to cover 80 to 90% of this conversation. Is your kid's mouth open at night? Do they snore? Are they tired in the morning? Three things: mouth open, snoring, tired. If your kid's got those things, combination one, two, three of the above, you have an underlying medical problem. Now, I can't tell you exactly what that medical problem is going to be. I can give you the vibe of it, but you've got an underlying medical problem that your child needs to seek professional care for. But be warned, your doctor may not know what we're talking about.
No.
And be aware, it is not their fault. All right?
No, because they didn't learn it. Yep.
Let's just get over the blame game right there. Okay.
Yes.
But that's where things like this foundation can give the parents what they want and what they need so that they can go in there with awareness. Okay. So that they can go, and they need to be the advocate and say, look,
Right.
I have concerns about my child. I spend more time with my child than you are in this 3 to 10 minute conversation piece. And I have concerns about my child. I have noticed that they sleep with their mouth open at night. And I have become aware that that is not a normal breathing pattern and can be a sign that their airway, their breathing channels are blocked. And whilst it's good that they have the mouth to breathe through, it's the nose that they should be using instead. And I want to
Right.
know why. I have learned that snoring is a noise that is made because there is a blockage in the airway. I thought it was cute and humorous and funny. I've come now to realize it is actually a warning sign of some form of breathing and sleep
We
problem.
need to normalize. It's not cute. It's kind of terrifying. So, as a
Yeah.
parent, let's shift
Yeah.
that.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the third thing is waking up tired. Now, waking up tired again doesn't
It's a
point
tricky
into
one.
the reason. It can be a sleep quality problem. It can be a sleep quantity problem. It can actually be due to other underlying medical diseases that are not related to ear, nose, and throat at all. So from that point of view, for adults and children alike, by the way, waking up tired, that is actually a really serious red flag in the medical speak that needs to be reviewed and assessed and investigated for. And we're going to have the tunnel vision in this talk with airway because that's what we're here for. But I just want to broaden the horizons just to highlight it. So, like I said, there's your sound grab right there. Mouth
Right.
breathing, snoring, tired. Not normal.
Not normal.
Not
I want to
normal.
ask about one of the questions that we received from parents was about, and I see this a lot in my Insta feed as well, so I know it's out there, the term neurodivergent. And I'm going to
Yep.
tell you right now, Gen Z has grabbed this, they're making videos. They're all excited because I'm neurodivergent. I'm in the world. And parents are going, what is that? Is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing?
Yep. So again, words have been weaponized, in some respects. And you know, the political correctness has its place. There are certain things that, you know, we grew up with kids that we said that were just abhorrent when we look back at it, you know,
Oh,
in terms
yeah.
of what we said. But hey, you know what? We were kids. We were innocent in the big scheme of things. There was nothing
Sure.
overtly malicious that, and so forth. So let's just be careful about where we draw some lines in the sand here. So one of the things that has been weaponized is the word spectrum as part of the ASD acronym of Autism Spectrum Disorder. Spectrum just means that there's a spread. I mean, let's just use the
Because
word in.
technically, aren't we all on the spectrum? I mean, it's like a giant
Exactly.
spectrum. We're
We
all
are.
on it.
Everybody's on the spectrum. We're on the spectrum of height. We're on the spectrum
Good
of hair
point.
color. We're on the spectrum of skin color. You know, tell me where you want to stop. We're on the spectrum of food
Right.
choices. We're on the spectrum of religions. We're on the spectrum of countries of origin. That's what a spectrum means, you know.
Right.
And what it is basically, you know, and it comes from, you know, the idea of light. You know, we split light out into its wavelengths, and then we see a rainbow. A rainbow is a spectrum of color. You know,
Right.
that's what the word means. So when you bring it back, it means that we are all, as a starting point, the same, but then we can start to spread ourselves out to see how we're also not quite the same. But inside, we're all the same. We have to be all the same. You know, we make these pretend differences and so forth. And it seems to be a human trait. It doesn't matter what we want to nominate. We
Right.
have this somehow programmed desire to find differences, and then sometimes we make those differences issues. And now we use the words to make it. And it's like, you can't call me autistic, I'm neurodivergent. And you know what? That's fine. If that is important to you, I recognize that. But let's not then assume that me using the word autistic is me somehow attacking you. That's
Right.
not this. That's not what this is all about. So, what is neurodivergent? Well, it's no different. Neuro means brain, okay? Divergent means different. Spectrum. It's this, you know.
Crazy,
So
yeah.
you know. So it's just an identification thing, and that's fine. You know, if somebody wants to, you know, use a particular term that they identify with more, that's okay. You know, and we have these things, you know, like when I grew up as a kid, I had asthma, okay? And you know, so I said, oh, I'm asthmatic, you know. Now you can't say I'm asthmatic, you say I have asthma because I don't identify, you know, being asthmatic is not my identity. Asthma is one of my clinical diagnoses. I'm so, so you can't say
That
someone
makes
is
sense.
autistic because you're basically saying that's them in a nutshell. You know, it's no different. You know, it's like,
Right.
well, we're weaponizing words when we actually, let's just get on with what we can probably put our energy into better, which is understanding the condition, understanding the individual, and just get on with the fact that, you know, whilst we're different, we're also the same. We just got to work out, you know, like it's like when you meet someone from a different country and they have different cultures and different belief systems. You come into it with respect and understanding, and some of it will be like, oh, okay, this is a bit strange, but you want to make them feel comfortable, so you accommodate
Right.
them, and they're doing the same. You know, it's a two-way street. So, you know, so I think we need to just, you know, just realize we don't need to weaponize words. What we do need to do is actually deal with the underlying issues. So when it comes to being neurodivergent, I'm neurodivergent, you're neurodivergent. Okay. And if people want to, you know, wear that as an identity for some reason that serves a purpose to them, that's okay. All right. But again, it's really distraction from what we really need to be focusing on, which is to go, all right, we've talked about the sort of the ADHD side of it. Now we've got the autism side of it. And let's go, all right, well, where's autism come into the mix? Well, autism, again, wasn't a thing. In fact, historically, The first cases of autism were linked in with schizophrenia. They thought it was a form of schizophrenia. In terms of behaviors and so forth. And then it was sort of described separately. So the autism word is actually historically embedded with schizophrenic autism. And then the other word that came into being was actually the person that described it was Asperger's. And these things were described in around about 2 or 3 years apart from each other in different parts of the world, and sort of coexisted and co-evolved, and then started to merge, where Asperger's was then recognized as what we would possibly now call high functioning autism. As a example of things. And moving forwards with that being the case, autism as a diagnosis again has sort of evolved and been refined and defined, so that we can again start ticking boxes and so forth, so that we can put things into categories and so forth. Not with a point too much, and it shouldn't be about putting a label on it, but it's really just a conduit. The reason you said you had cancer, all right? So when you say you had cancer, that means one thing, but it also is pretty meaningless in the context of, well, I don't know what sort of cancer you got, which means I don't know how we're going to fix it. I don't know how we can help you. You say I've got cancer, you go, well, look, I've got this whole range of cancer therapies. But was that a skin cancer or a bowel cancer or a breast cancer? Because that conversation is totally different. So we do need to label your cancer to provide a treatment, provide a management plan that is best suited. And that's the whole point of having these categories and so forth. It's like reason that we've categorized it and put it into this little box is not to put you in the box. It's to help us then
That's your
understand.
treatment.
What belongs to that box that's going to help you as an individual with, insert name of medical condition, doesn't matter what it is. There's a reason and a purpose. It's not a
So why are we
label.
seeing it so much that they talk about ADHD and neurodivergence together? I mean, is it possible that
No. Again, there's no reason that things can't coexist. One of the things that we're sort of coming to understand, because people go, look, why my child? Why, what happened? And the first thing you've got to do is we've got to eliminate how this, especially with the ASD, the autism, how this started. It was parental blame. You go back to the 50s and the 60s, it was all blamed on the parents. It was the parents' fault. That's just the nonsense right there. We need to just beds with that right there. It has got nothing to do with parenting. It's got everything to do with brain development. And in particular, just how fragile that development is, and how these things can come along that seem quite innocuous, that can have a marked impact. And when it comes to ADHD and ASD, there's a lot of things in commonality that can affect brain development. And it really just depends on which way it pushes you, as to whether it has no impact at all, or if it has an ADHD impact, or it has an ASD impact, or it has an ADHD and ASD impact. Because again, there's commonality there. It's why, for example, someone that smokes can get lung cancer, or they can get throat cancer, or they can get both. It's the same deal, okay? Because cigarettes can do those things. It's the same thing. So and from an ear, nose, and throat point of view, look, breathing and sleep mucks up brain development in ways that it affects brain development that is consistent with the things that we see in the brain development of ADHD, in the brain development of autism. These things can have underlying contributing factors that can lead to the brain development to the point that there is enough of a divergence that we see you at the extreme end of the spectrum. Okay.
Got
And
it.
when you're at the extreme end of the spectrum, that's where we're drawing some lines in the sand to say, you know what, you're actually at the point where this is dysfunctional from what it needs to be, let us then find ways that we can help help you with this. And when we look at things in terms of autism, ADHD, look, it starts in pregnancy, okay, like in utero. And it actually starts one step before that. It starts with your genetics. We know there are certain underlying genetic factors in play with both of these conditions, more so what we've found with the autism side of things. We know there's pregnancy-related issues, including, by the way, the mum having obstructive sleep apnea herself during pregnancy. We know that there are, early things that happen in life. So, like getting infections, being premature birth, getting infections young, these things all play into it. And then we have other things that come along, and then, breathing and sleep is one of them. Like even just ear infections is another. Just the innocuous, oh, my child got a few ear infections. Yeah, in most of the cases it is innocuous, a few ear infections. But if there is anything in the programming that is an underlying, and the word is tendency. If you have a possibility that you could end up with this, okay, then it might happen. So again, if we go back to the cigarette smoking, for example, cigarette smoking bad. Let's just cut it for what it is. There's no excuse otherwise. But if you've got some really bad genetics in your mix, that means that if you smoke, you're going to get lung cancer real bad, real quick. Well, if you don't smoke, you may not get that lung cancer. You might get away with it, but you're really bad genetics, but you got away with
But
it
you're genetically
because you
predisposed,
didn't get,
but you
but you've
didn't
got
trigger it, basically.
the trigger wasn't there to trip you over onto that. It's the same thing. We can find these genetic changes in people that don't have the manifestations of the genetics, and that's because it's not just genetics. It's genetics, it's environment, all sort of blended together. And it's really just a matter of having those things that come along. And
And
of
that's, are we getting
all,
into epigenetics at this point or
yeah,
epigenetics
look,
in general?
there's all those dynamics that come into play. And epigenetics is, again, when I went to university, that was just the rubbish part of DNA. And now we're realizing, hang on a sec, yes, maybe it's not rubbish after all. And so forth. That's sort of, we're still trying to unravel that. There's so much we don't know.
You can stay connected with the Children's Airway First Foundation by following us on Instagram, Facebook, X, LinkedIn, and YouTube. Don't forget to subscribe to the Airway First podcast on your favorite podcasting platform so you won't miss an upcoming episode. If you'd like to be a guest or have an idea for an upcoming show, shoot us a note via the contacts page on our website or send us an email directly at info@childrensairwayfirst.org. Today's episode was written and directed by Rebecca St. James, video editing and promotion by Ryan Drawn, and guest outreach by Christy Bojinkian. And finally, thanks to all the parents and medical professionals out there that are working hard to help make the lives of kids around the globe just a little bit better. Take care, stay safe, and happy breathing, everyone.